Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is April the 10th, 2025. It is Thursday. That means it's time for an expert panel Q&A show for the week. And I've got a good lineup for you today with some members of the expert council that we hadn't heard from in quite a while. One we hear from every week is Dr. Paul and either Dan McAdams or Chris Rossini over at the Liberty Report with their highlight reel for the week for us. And today they're going to talk about how Trump is about to pump more money into what already bankrupted us. And I haven't listened to this one yet, but I think he means the defense spending. It's like a $1 trillion defense spending initiative they're trying to put forward. Which Trump is very, very proud of. The most money ever. It's great. It's huge. Everybody knows it. It's the best spending bill ever. That's not why you were sent there, bro. Like, we want spending cut, and they're not cutting anything. They're expanding spending again. Andy McCann will talk about the lion diet, specifically for people dealing with Crohn's disease. Patrick Rohrman will talk about choosing sharpening stones and provided us a list of three specific stones that are in the show notes as well with links so you can see what he's talking about. Then we have a question that's really kind of a hard question, man. We got somebody with a history of prostate cancer in their family and has seen people go through the treatment for it and wants to know what life looks like if you don't treat it and just accept your destiny. Dr. Bones will talk about that. Ben Falk will talk about dealing with an apple tree that's planted too deep. I'll have some add-ons to that, and I'll put a link under Ben's bullet point over to Howard Garrett's sick tree treatment, which will give you some advice to kind of go along with what Ben says. When you're planted too deep, there's a litany of problems this can create for trees, even more than Ben says, but his method of fixing the problem is probably the right one here, in most instances anyway. And then I got one for you. I got 10 short pieces of advice today for 18-year-olds, and this is really 15-year-olds, 25-year-olds, even 30-year-olds to a degree. But the world's changed, and I asked ChatGPT about this. And usually when I do that, I have to, like, go take out six, add four, add more to four, like, just give me different stuff. Like, I'll pick and choose, or go ahead and expand it to 20, and then I'll pick 10 if I want 10 points. No. In fact, it was kind of weird. This advice sounds a lot like what I've advised overall for a long time with some unique differences. But there is no doubt, and we need to stop beating up young people. Like, it's easy to do because so many of them can't do anything. But again, that's always the fault of their parents, and the generation before them was supposed to teach them. But the other side of it is the world really is different. It's not the way it used to be, and there's more opportunities, but there's harsher realities at the same time. And what I mean by that is that while it's not the path that I chose, because I'm a different kind of person than normal, but if you go back to when I was in high school in the 1980s, all you really had to do if you wanted a pretty good guarantee of success in life is the following. Shut your hole, listen to your teachers, and do what they tell you to do, even if you disagree with it. Do your very best in school, and if your IQ was over 80, you probably could have got out with at least a B average, at least. If you were a relatively intelligent person, you should have been able to get straight A's or close, something like a 3.7, 3.8 GPA. That would have gotten you into a college somewhere that was relatively affordable compared to today, and then take a degree path that had an opportunity at the end of it. That's, you'd pick a decent degree path, right? And then when you got out, look for your entry-level job and be willing to move somewhere and go there and do a good job. And then immediately start making more than minimum payments on your student loan debt. Then go and look for a house and get some credit lined up and start spending some money and buy a house as soon as you can. Buy a house within you could afford, but buy it as soon as you can and start making payments. And then get a spouse and start making babies. And if you did that and you were 18 years old, let's say 85, 87, 91, like somewhere in that range, your life probably worked out. And you're probably a Gen Xer sitting in a pretty good space in life right now. Maybe it's not everything you dreamed it would be, but it seldom is. But it overall worked out. You know what? That formula doesn't work anymore. And it ain't that it doesn't work at all. It will work for a certain percentage of the people that do it. But the deck is stacked against you. And the demographic we used to think of is the privileged demographic, the white male, and to a lesser degree, white female. It's actually a worse path now for you than it is for a minority or at least a female. I know that's like, oh God, Jax, just hammering the woke again. Now, I'm just telling you. I've seen enough young people online, 18-year-old kid in high school with a 4.0 GPA that took advanced courses, that has a bunch of, advanced courses where they already have college credit for them, good extracurricular activity, can't get into a top school. Just can't, like, won't even get an answer. Like, go screw off. So there is a door that is closed in a lot of places. I've had people email me from this audience. One worked for National Geographic. Guy's been there 10 years, highly qualified, does his job, never misses a day of work. And he was basically told by a higher up, you might as well quit, or this is what you're going to do for the rest of your life. You're never getting promoted. And told him flat out, it's because you're a white male. Now, some of that DEI shit's getting pulled back because it's fucking shit up, just to be honest. But it ain't going away. We have to take a different path through life now. And I think that my advice is good. It doesn't matter what your race is or whatever. The advice that I'll give you today in my segment will work for you. But, you know, for a segment of society that always considered their opportunities unlimited, your opportunities are limited. If you stay on the path that is laid out for you by other people. If you make your own way, the others will follow, and your path truly is unlimited. So we're going to come at this today from that standpoint, advice to the youth, but it's good advice, I think, for everyone. And we'll get to that in just a minute. Just real quick, I want to remind you guys you can help support us by doing your online shopping where? tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. And I do still have the same two items of the day today from the rest of the week for you, because they're both still on sale at really stupid cheap prices for what they are. One is the Frigidaire 26-pound-a-day portable compact ice maker. This thing is awesome. I own two of them, and I almost own three because the price on one of them is so stupid cheap, I'm almost willing to buy one even though I don't need it. So this thing usually retails for about $100, and it's totally worth it. The black stainless model, which is the one that I like, I think looks the best, is on sale for $84. That's a deal. But the stainless steel one, like the silver stainless, $57.58. Now, guys, that is a deal on something that every prepper should have anyway. You should have an ice maker in your home. You really should, because it does so much for you in so many situations that we end up in, like the power's out. You can run one of these things with an 800-watt inverter off of your car. If you can make ice, you can keep your food cold, even if you don't have a generator. That's just one example, and it's a great convenience item. To me, it's the perfect prepper item, right? It meets the, like, it's not the perfect prepper. It's a perfect prepper item is what I'm saying, because it meets the biggest criteria I have for that. Something that improves your life on a daily basis, even if nothing goes wrong, but helps you if something does go wrong. The next one doesn't really do that, but it is a great tool for your kitchen. It's the Meter Block Smart Meat Thermometer. This thing is still on sale for like $160 for the 4-probe model. It's been well over $200 for years, and I've been waiting for the price to drop on the damn thing before I bring it around. But it is a sale, and it's listed as a limited-time deal on Amazon. If you've had this on your radar, now would be the time to act. I'll put it to you this way. The 2-probe meter block, so you can only do two cuts at a time, is $159. And the 4-probe one is $159. That tells you something. So those are just some great options for you this week. And if you're on the Daily Mail, you know that because you get a Daily Mail with the stuff in it. So get on the Daily Mail too. And with that, let's go ahead and drop on in to our first segment. Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams discussing how Trump's going all in on spending more money on the things that already bankrupted us.
There's fighting too many wars and we're spending too much money at home. So what are we going to do about it? We've been telling people they shouldn't do that, but they just aren't listening. Well, we applauded, you know, this this new committee, Doge and Musk and even Trump and even we praised them. But it doesn't look like it's getting very far. And because the news item that we've discovered today that sort of dampens our enthusiasm is the announcement by the administration. Hegseth says Pentagon will get its first $1 trillion DOD budget. And then if you read the article in Anti-War, they say, you know, next year, because of some hidden ways they hide the spending and the momentum, they're saying the military budget next year could be $2 trillion. I'll tell people listening, don't sweat it. We'll never make it that far. You know, if we're going to spend like that, there may be a conclusion to all this. So it's rather disturbing. And I'm going to check with Chris, see if he's been disturbed by $1 trillion. Maybe he's not going to get upset until it's $2 trillion. How about that, Chris?
I don't know. I hope we don't get that far down. But I think you're right, Dr. Paul. I don't know if we would make it to $2 trillion. You're 100% correct. We started off hot, the Trump administration. We were excited ourselves. Cutting, actual cutting with Doge was happening. Finally, you know, this is something that never happens. But as the weeks go on, we started to notice, you know, this is only like leftist stuff, good stuff that was being cut, but only the Democrats were upset. And anybody who's been around a little while knows that our problem is not simply the Democrats. It's Democrats and Republicans. And the Republicans are not upset. And in fact, Pete Hegseth, as you mentioned, Dr. Paul, thank you, Mr. President, he says, coming soon, the first $1 trillion Department of Defense budget. President Trump is rebuilding our military and fast. And here's the funny part. P.S. We intend to spend every taxpayer dollar wisely on lethality and readiness, end quote. I mean, how stupid does he think Americans are? If the military was efficient, they would cut it 50-75% from what it is now, not increase to $1 trillion. So it is starting to feel like we've been duped. You know, the question has always been in my mind, will President Trump try to save the empire or save the nation, America? And by all, you know, appearances today, it's looking like he's trying to save the empire, which means that it's going to bankrupt the nation.
Let me throw a little gas on their fire here for you for some reality. Right now, we have a problem with actually producing things for our defense because we don't make enough steel and we don't have enough facilities to build the shit that we need to build to defend our country with. But they're going to put the money out there anyway to spend it because you got to spend it because you got to spend it and you have to do it. And it sounds like a big deal when you. Here's what I mean. Right now, we have orders out for 10 new battleships. Well, not battleships, 10 new ships for the Navy. Some of them are, you know, the modern battleship ain't I don't like using that word because it ain't what it used to be. It's a different type of vessel. 10 of them. Cutting edge. Top warfighting ships. We have an order for 10 of them out there to be built. In the next 4 years, we'll be lucky if they produce 4 of the 10 that are on order. Why? Because the shipbuilding yards are gone. That's why. The Philadelphia shipyard is desolate. There's almost nobody there. And here's what you got to, like, we have problems across the board. Do you want to use Chinese steel to build American ships for our defense? Do you really? And if we ever have to get on a war footing, can you rely on China to provide you the steel to gear up during wartime? Now you got a problem there, don't we? But there's more to it. And we can just start building ships again. I mean, come on. Who's going to do it? What do you mean, Jack? People want jobs? Yeah, people want jobs. But, like, building ships or building some of these munition systems, a lot of this stuff, and the raw materials thereof, these are not things you train a person how to do in a week. Some of this work is incredibly specialized work, and a lot of people that were trained in it are retired or gone on something else now. They're not coming back. So what good does it do to jack up spending that much on your defense if you can't actually build the things the Defense Department needs for the various branches of the military? What are we going to do, just make a bunch more F-35s because they sound really cool when they fly over your house? Like, is that what we need? Do we need to be investing in drone warfare? Where is this money going to go? And a lot of it's going to go into shit you don't know about, and you're not going to know about, and you're never going to know about it, and half of it will completely fail. But let's spend it anyway. What about rebuilding the country's ability to produce things, which would include things like ships for our defense, ammunition systems, etc. But like, would also include like all the things that we want to tariff the shit out of that come into this country because we don't make enough in America. We need to rebuild our country more than we need to rebuild our military. Because I'm going to tell you the truth right now, no matter what scare tactics they use again, no one's fucking with this country from a military standpoint. It ain't happening. The word Pyrrhic victory doesn't even apply. There'd be no victory, and it'd be far worse than Pyrrhic. Okay? I mean, it would be an absolute death sentence to anybody who militarily attacked the U.S. homeland in any significant military engaged way. Like terrorism and stuff, you know, when it's real and it's not fake, that can be very damaging to the country. But, I mean, if you're talking about full-on military assault, country-on-country war, they're in a place we can't turn into a glass factory in 24 hours. How much do we need? How much do we need? How about we get all the idiots that are in our military out of it, all these incompetent people, all these diversity hires, and we actually just focus on making the military better? I think there's enough money there already, but you know what? None of this matters. And it was almost my subject today, basically, stop expecting Trump or any politician to save you. So I decided to go a different way for my anchor segment, and it's probably a good idea. Just some thoughts that I have to add on there. Now let's talk about something different. Let's say you're dealing with Crohn's disease. Might the lion diet, which is a version of the carnivore diet, be helpful to you? Andy McCann will answer that.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, here at CrossFit Garage, and I got a question here from Don, and it has to do with Crohn's or a GI disorder. And so the question is, how long did your son Evan have to stay on the lion diet to get into remission? So I'm going to answer that. Basically 4 months. I'm going to go into that. And then will his son have to stay on this diet for the rest of his life? The answer is no. And so I'm going to kind of go through what we did. So the details for Don is he has a 17-year-old. I have a 20-year-old. Well, now 21-year-old. And they've got GI disorders such that you're doing a colonoscopy and an endoscopy, and you're like, what's going on? You're losing weight. Can't keep food down. So Evan went to the doctor after coming back from college and living a mostly healthy life except going to college and then living in a bad environment for a year, fraternity house, and then going on a cruise with his fraternity and having some sushi on island, so maybe parasites, and then eating a bunch of crap food that they serve you up there at college, right? So he's at University of Georgia, UGA, and their food looked pretty good, but I mean, when you mass produce food, is it really food? I don't know. Anyway, so Evan went to the doctor, and the doctor said, basically, we think you have Crohn's. It all presents very similar, except it's on the transverse rather than the up and down side of the colon, or the colon, or large intestines. And they said, basically, you could take a drug, a biological, it'll rewrite some DNA, and you won't feel any pain. And you probably won't have any flare-ups, but most likely we'll have to cut your colon out and give you a colostomy bag. And so when we left, he said, Dad, that's a really bad option. Can we do something else? I said, Son, you're 20. You can do whatever you want, and I'll be there every step of the way. So he found Michaela Peterson and the Lion Diet, and he said, this is what I want to try. I said, all right, let's do it. So he and I did the Lion Diet for about 4 months. That's where the magic happened for him. Will it be the same for you? I don't know. I'm not a doctor, and I didn't sleep at a Holiday Inn Express. Guys, I think it's just basically how messed up are you, and what do you need to get you through it? So the other thing that Evan did is we signed him up with Josh Detch's The Gut Health Solution. You can find them at gutsolution.ca for Canada. I'm not affiliated with them at all, but it's worked. it costs about $500 a month. There's a startup fee, and I would pay it all over again. I'd pay it double. I mean, what would you pay for your son's life, right? So Evan is doing well. He has mixed other foods in there. The second question is, how long would he have to stay on this? So I think the real answer is, once you realize that not all food is food, you're going to probably stop wanting to eat that stuff. So I would first say get off of sugars and then processed foods and then your seed oils. But hey, that's me. I know Jack probably agrees with that. You guys do you. I really think there's some sort of science, magic, whatever you want to call it, in this lion diet, the ruminant meat. Anyway, so it was 4 months for him, and he's on other stuff now. He's been able to add in things quickly, like egg, goat cheese, and then slowly some fruits in a small quantity. No breads at all, except sourdough bread. So weirdly, I guess because it's fermented, it has something different in it. He was also able to add in more of the A2 style of milk or cow product rather than the A1 cow product, which that's a whole other discussion. So the way to get away from this A2, A1 is just go goat or sheep and you'll be fine. But it's taken a while, and it's still 9 months. I guess maybe actually now going on the 10th month, and he's doing better. So Evan basically went from 175-pound, 6-foot man down to 117-pound man, when he came home from college. He's like, dude, something is not right. You're going to die. We need to change everything we're doing. We tried to do it all naturopathic. It didn't work. And so hence the doctor and him finding the lion diet. So I credit that to him. But it did work, and I'm on it as well. It works for people who don't have problems. I did lose a bunch of weight, maybe 10 pounds, which I don't really have that to lose. I'm a pretty small guy. So I keep my calorie and my fat count way high. I'm up in the 4,000s calories, like 4,400 calories a day, and I'm able to maintain weight. So this is good. It does work. Maybe we should do a whole show on this. Or actually, you know what? I'll tell you what. If you go to my podcast, Food, Fitness, and Finance, you can type in Crohn's, and you'll see we've got 4 episodes in there. Let me double check. Yep, 4 episodes in there that cover Evan and his Crohn's. I think most of them are with me and him, so you get to hear it from his point of view. It's episodes 140, 141, 159, and 168. We plan to do another one soon, to kind of give a follow-up where he's been, because it's been quite a while. The last one was in November, and a lot of stuff has changed. In December, he was able to really eat with me and put on a lot of weight, and so we figured out a few pretty powerful things, and we want to bring that to you guys. So anyway, if you go to my podcast and type in Crohn's, you will pull up a bunch of podcasts that we cover for him. All right, guys. Hey, good luck with that. You're not alone. If you've got a problem or an issue and you want to talk, as Don found out, if you call or text, I will pick up the phone and talk to you, because this is what I'm here for. I'm here to help. Don't go it alone. All right, guys. Take care.
Good stuff from Andy, as always. And I will tell you that I am down to one Andy question. One Andy question in the bank where I have an answer from Andy. And Andy gets on it hard, almost overdoes it. And the reason I bring that up is that means I'm low on questions. I think I have 3 in the bank for next week, and I sandbagged a little bit. I usually do 6 expert segments, and this week I sandbagged it to 5 because I am limited on my questions in the bank. What does that mean? It means I need you, dear listeners, to send in some questions for expert council members. The way to do that, send it to Jack at thesurvivalpodcast.com. Put TSPC in the subject line, and TSPC expert would be good for an expert panel question. When I get your email, when I open it, this is what I should see. My question is, for expert panel member, fill in the blank. Don't put fill in the blank. All right? My question is a clear, concise question in a single sentence with a question mark at the end of it. And then there should be a couple returns that you hit. And if you have details, this is where you apply your details. This means we're all clear, you, me, and the expert, on what you're asking, and your odds of getting an answer go way up, and your odds of getting an answer that's actually going to be beneficial to you go up immensely, because even if they try, if they get the wrong question out of rambling, you won't get the answer you're looking for. So be direct. Pretend you're asking a question of a politician. You want to be direct and clear, so when they try to change the question, you go, no, I asked you this. You have to be clear, and then you get clear answers. All right, I'm a professional. I've been doing it for 17 years coming this summer, so trust me when I tell you it works. Next up today, let's talk about sharpening stones and choosing the right ones for the right job for sharpening your knives. With somebody who knows a little bit about that, Mr. Patrick Rohrman.
Hey guys, it's Patrick with MT Knives coming to you today with today's Expert Counsel segment of the week. Today's question comes from Luke. Luke says, hi, question for Patrick. What kind of stone would you recommend for someone who wants to start learning to sharpen knives? I have had several cheap pull-through sharpeners in the past, and on your last interview, which I don't remember any actual recommendations you had, how with a good stone you can make the blades extremely sharp, and I'd like to learn that skill. Thank you, Luke. Thanks for the question, Luke. When it comes to stones, I've always recommended the King 1000 Grit Japanese Water Stone. It's a great stone for the money, and it's what I started with. However, over the years, my recommendations could be different depending on your situation. There's a diamond stone on the market that's not bad, and it's the I'll leave a link in the description, but it's a double-sided diamond. It's got a coarse and a fine side, and it cuts really aggressively. And what I'm looking for when it comes to beginner sharpening, I want something that's going to remove steel efficiently so that you can remove the burr quickly, or that you can establish a burr quickly. Because a lot of times, if you have like an old oil stone or, you know, whatever, some of those stones, they can be loaded up, just not cut efficiently, and you might be doing things fine, but you might not establish that burr quickly. You might start changing things, thinking that you're not doing it properly. So that's the big thing, is you want a stone that's going to remove steel efficiently, quickly, and get that burr raised as quick as possible. That's also why I always recommend beginners starting out with a knife that's not extremely dull. If a knife has been used and abused and hasn't been sharpened in a very long time, it can take quite a bit of work to establish a burr. A lot of times, you're just better off taking that knife to a machine, raising the burr, and get going. Now, with a good stone and somebody that knows what they're doing, they can raise a burr fairly efficiently with stones. However, no matter which way you shake it, there's no way you're going to remove steel as fast as a machine. I can, with a matter of 1, 2, 3 passes, have a burr raised on a machine. Get a good stone, like the King 1000 Waterstone, the Diamond Stone that I recommend, or, you know, those are really my two number one recommendations. The reason I try to stay away from diamond, the good thing about diamonds is they stay flat. When they're brand new, they cut really efficiently, really quick. And sometimes with like cheap diamonds, I'm not really a fan of the way they feel. I don't like the overall experience of sharpening with diamonds for the most part. Japanese water stones, a nice 400 to 1000 grit stone that's going to remove steel quickly. Now, with the Japanese stones, they're going to wear. You got to keep them flat, different things like that. So, anyways, my recommendation, the King 1000 Grit or the Sharpenol Diamond Double-Sided Stone. I'll leave links to both those in the description. Thank you, Luke, for your question. Good luck in sharpening. If you need anything else, be sure to check out my website where I've got digital downloads for my ebook or my sharpening video. If you'd like a little more information, this has been Patrick with MT Knives. Have a great day.
Good stuff from Patrick, and he actually sent links for 3 different stones, one of them being the diamond stone that he started off with, the other being the 1000 grit medium stone, and the other being a King whetstone. It's a 6000 grit, very, very fine stone. I've got links to all of those for you in the show notes. You'll see it right under Patrick's primary bullet point. So that's there for you. Now let's hear from Doc Bones on a subject that I'm really interested to hear what he has to say about it. A person who is thinking about if they end up with prostate cancer, which based on their family history and their current PSA is likely, they may choose not to treat it and to let nature take its course, and they want to know what that would look like. I have to say, this is the first question like this that I've ever gotten from this audience in almost 17 years. Doc, what do you say about it?
Hi, Joel Nemdi here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning 4th edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Today's question for the Expert Council comes from Sean, who writes, Doc Bones, can you give me some practical advice? Online searches do not give any real kind of answers. Could you please describe what living with prostate cancer would be like, including the end? I am 55 years old, and to say prostate cancer runs in my family is an understatement. It hit my father, his two brothers, and a cousin who got it in his 20s, of all things. My PSA, it's a blood test, is currently about 8.7 and I am being tested, but I am sure if it does not hit me now, it will in a few years. My question is, if I decide to forego treatment, in general, what kind of quality of life would I have? I know treatment has changed since my father in the mid-1990s, but his quality of life was not good. The meds and treatment were never-ending and rough. He had an accidental death after about 20 years of decline. I do not want to sound morbid, but I do not see myself living past age 70 or so. I have multiple issues that I feel will limit me to about that age. Additionally, I have long ago decided that when it comes to treatment and longer life versus live what I have left in comfort, I prefer the latter. I both do not want to go through rough treatments that make me sick in the short term while bankrupting myself or being a burden to those around me. I prefer to avoid that and have something to leave to my heirs and the local dog shelter. So back to the question. If diagnosed, I have read a person can live years. Is this the case? And what kind of discomfort would one live in versus what you go through in treatment? I thank you for your time. Sean, I'm so sorry about your family history of prostate cancer, which is certainly a concern. The prostate is one of the most common cancers among men in the United States. As a matter of fact, in 2021, there were close to 250,000 new cases reported in just the United States. My impression is that you're right. You're definitely a candidate for prostate cancer, and your blood test is higher than it normally should be. The good news is that the average age at diagnosis is about 67 years old, you're 55, and 70% of cases are diagnosed at a localized stage. That means it's restricted to the prostate gland itself and hasn't gone anywhere else. Survival's high because many prostate cancers grow slowly, or not at all in some cases. Due to medical advances, 97% of prostate cancer patients are alive 5 years later. That's 97%, meaning your odds of passing the 70-year mark is very good. However, survival varies by the stage at diagnosis. Has it spread to the rest of the pelvis? Has it spread to lymph nodes? Has it spread to other areas? When this type of cancer is spread, it tends to first show up in the tissues or lymph nodes that are closest to the prostate gland. If it's caught and treated at this point, which is known as the regional stage, your odds of recovery are very, very good. If it travels further, the cancer usually ends up in your bones. At that point, the chances for survival drop to about 29%. Pain is usually the end result if it's there. Organ failure and sepsis are possible life-ending events in the most extreme cases. You asked about the end. There are a lot of options like surgery, radiation, and even hormonal treatment. Hormonal therapy is usually used when the cancer is spread and is meant to lower the amount of male hormones like testosterone, which feeds prostate cancer cells. There's also chemotherapy, so there are a lot of choices. I guess I don't have to mention, though, that there are issues with urination and your sex life. That's all part of the equation. If hormone therapy doesn't work, you might have to move on to vaccine therapy. The prostate cancer vaccine is designed to kickstart your immune system so it attacks cancer cells. Or your doctor might suggest chemotherapy. It might be a medication you take by mouth or something your doctor injects into a vein. As I said earlier, if the cancer has spread to your bones, you'll need pain meds, maybe steroids, and a strategy to prevent fractures in whatever weakened structure that may be bony in nature. But we're getting ahead of ourselves, Sean. There are a lot worse cancers to have, and we're not even certain that you have it at this point. Make sure your doctor knows about your family history, though. That's very important. And figure out together how to evaluate your elevated blood test and how to proceed in a way that matches your personal needs and desires. Hang in there, Sean. I'm rooting for you. This is Joe Alden, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health and good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about the more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning 4th edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
So I have a few additional thoughts on this one. First of all, I very much understand the idea of if you have cancer, considering not doing anything about it at all and letting cancer take its natural path and accepting your mortality. Now, would I do it? Well, the answer is I don't know. And I think that anybody that says they know before they're actually faced with the full reality, not even it's likely that you will, but you hear those words that change your life forever, you have cancer, and you don't know what you would do until you actually face that. No one does. Just like no one knows what they're going to do when they face death, especially if it's like an untimely death, like if you're going to be shot or something. You do not know how you're reacting to that. And it's the same thing. You're just, you know, one is a death now and one is a death soon. And it's the same confrontation in life that you'll have to deal with someday. So I don't know. My guess is it would be highly dependent on what the treatment path looks like and what the treatment path's success rate is. I can tell you right now, it is very unlikely if I have a doctor tell me, you have cancer, Mr. Spirico, there is nothing we can do. It's inoperable. It's not curable. We can't stop it. But if you do this path of, you know, radiation and chemotherapy, it could give you a few more months. Then I can pretty much tell you that my instinct is I'm saying hell no to that. Because I've seen what it does to people too, and I don't believe that it actually gives them that much more time. And I think it destroys the time that they have in many instances. There's also cancers that have like massively high successful cure rates. And this is the thing. In many instances, prostate cancer is one of them. My father-in-law had prostate cancer at least 30 years before I even met him, let alone before he died. And it had actually gotten into a little bit of his tailbone. He had to have his prostate removed and a piece of his tailbone. And you know what? He lived a perfectly happy life. Into a fairly old age. He made 90, and he had a good life until he got Alzheimer's at the end of it, but I don't think he would give up the almost 40 years that he gained by seeking treatment for that, and that's a long time ago. So I think that this person needs to really evaluate what a treatment path would look like today. And if you're worried about like male performance, if you have your prostate removed, I mean, obviously don't do it unless you have to. But the reality is that there are things that can be done that will give you that back. And I know more about that than I want to because old men tell you things you don't want to hear, you know, like about their personal lives. I don't need to know, Fred, but yet I know those things. So, you don't necessarily lose that component of your life. And even if I did, I'd rather be alive than dead if I can have a good quality of life. So think about that. Then I would also say if you ever make the decision with any cancer, I am not going to treat it with pharmaceuticals. I'm not going to use chemo. I'm not going to use radiation. If you make that choice, then there's nothing to be lost by pursuing whatever the best looking natural alternative to that might be. If it doesn't work, so what? Right, that's the thing. If it doesn't work, so what? And there are people, and you can't tell me otherwise, with certain cancers that have done things just simply with diet, and the body then is able to fight off the cancer. Like the cutting-edge cancer treatments that are coming, and I know some of you don't want to hear this because it's been so abused as a mass vaccination technology, is mRNA vaccines, which are not really vaccines. They're a genetic therapy. And it acts like a vaccine in that it switches on the body's immune system and says, attack this thing. And don't get all in my face about the spike proteins and all. I've talked about that. I'm not advocating that. There's no spike protein to be spoken of in this application. This is a technology. It is not a thing unto itself. And this technology, this mRNA tech, was developed specifically for this. It was never meant to be used for flu vaccines and cold vaccines and COVID vaccines or whatever the hell they want to call it. It was never meant for one vaccine to go into 10 million, 20 million, 100 million, a billion people. It was meant that the individual with a particular cancer, you could actually take that cancer cellular data, its RNA, and you could use it to create a tailor-made vaccine to the individual that would switch on their immunosystem and make it understand, this thing, you must kill this thing. And it does have some very promising-looking components to it. But what that tells us is the best defense against cancer, the best treatment of cancer, is your own immune system. And, you know, I really recommend the Sacred 7 Mushroom blend that I have at tspaz.com on the site. Just, you can pretty much go there and type in Sacred Mushroom, and you will find that write-up. I take it every day, a small amount of it in my coffee. I don't even notice it's there. I can't tell. I put it in the first cup, and the second cup don't taste no different to me because the amount's not that big. And this is one of these preventional things. And so I would say to this person, not only should you be thinking about a conventional treatment path if you get there and know fully what you would be getting into and what its success rate is and what success looks like, along with natural therapies if you get there, do something now, even if you don't have cancer, to help your body be more likely to either completely fight it off or slow its progression. And, you know, things like reishi and lion's mane and stuff like that, they have huge anti-cancer components to them. So I really recommend that you don't just resign yourself to, like, death with dignity, because in the end, death seldom has dignity. You know, death with dignity is when you're 90-plus years old and you go to sleep and you're like, well, tomorrow I guess I'm going to eat some porridge and walk around the yard and piddle a little bit and hopefully I'll be able to do that, and you're in basic, decent shape, and you go to sleep, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, you just shut off and you don't wake up. That's about as close to death with dignity as you're going to get. And it unfortunately doesn't go that way for many of us. So I'm not a believer in, you know, every extraordinary measure, but I'm also not a believer in resigning yourself to a fate, especially if there's a way to change your fate. And it sounds to me, based on it being prostate cancer and what I do know about it, there's probably a way to change your fate without spending years living with your hair falling out and all the other horrible things and your tongue peeling and stuff like that. I mean, that's what happened. My mother-in-law went through one series of chemo when she had liver and pancreatic cancer, which is a death sentence, and that's what happened to her. Like, her mouth and her tongue started peeling, and it was like, no more of this. So I get that, but I don't think that's where this person most likely is. So it's worth living if you can live with the quality of life. Let's talk about something totally different. Let's talk about a tree that's planted too deep.
Hey, Jack and all, Ben Falk with Whole Systems Design. Question about if you planted apple trees a little bit too deep a year ago, should you dig them up? Ideally, but apple trees can survive that way. I mean, oak trees and some others are supposedly a lot more sensitive. I would tend to try to maybe just pull some of the soil back and try to make a bigger watering ring and just like pull the material away from the base and just use it as a nice big wide watering ring so it doesn't just come back over it too quickly. It also depends if it's a wet or dry site. You know, it depends on a few things, I think, especially if it's wet or dry. Potentially, if it's a really steep slope, it'd be easy to just pull material away. And if it's really flat and wet, then maybe I'd lift it back up, because you always want to plant high and dry on wet ground and low and wet on dry ground. So you want to kind of compensate for what the conditions are. So that depends, you know, that's a factor. Yeah, but it's probably not a big deal to leave it, but again, take into context those other factors. Good luck.
So I did add to the show notes, right under Ben's primary bullet, a sub-bullet that will take you over to the Dirt Doctor, a.k.a. Howard Garrett's page on the sick tree treatment, where he talks about exposing the roots and the flare. And the flare is the point where the roots turn and come out. And if your tree looks like a telephone pole coming out of the ground, it is planted too deep. You should see, in the words of Howard Garrett, and I'll do my best impression of him, a flare, and I mean a dramatic flare. You need to expose the flare. So on the context that Ben was talking about, my question would be is, when you say you planted it too deep, do you even know what that means? Do you mean you planted it too deep in that that tree is so deep in the ground you've covered up the graft? Because then it's really too deep, and you may need it on only a one-year-old tree to actually dig up and replant it. And if that's how deep you are, that's probably what I'd recommend. Now, the other side of that is sometimes a grafted tree has a good 4 inches of trunk before it hits the graft, and sometimes it's an inch. And sometimes it's almost right where the flare starts. It's only a half inch up from the flare. In that case, I would take the approach of treating this tree like a mature tree that needs Garrett's sick tree treatment and expose the roots and expose the flare. And I just want to say this is an incredibly important aspect of tree planting that most people ignore. Most trees are planted too deeply, and it doesn't matter if it's an apple tree. Is it worse for an oak? Sure, okay, fine. It doesn't matter because what ends up happening is that trunk is not going to root unless it's one of some very specific trees that typically happens from, and it's going to eat away at the bark. Exposed roots will produce bark, but when you put bark in the ground, it rots. So you want to be able to see that flare. I really recommend you take a look at Howard Garrett's webpage on the subject here as a whole. And the reason I added this is less for the person asking the question, more for the rest of y'all. When you're planting your trees, if you cannot see the flare of the root, you are wrong. And if you're in Texas and you drive around and you see those mulch volcanoes, do not do that shit. Don't do it. If you don't know what it is, good. If you're from around Dallas-Fort Worth, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Every damn landscaper here does it. It is toxic to trees. No mulch goes against the trunk of your tree, let alone 6-8 inches up the damn tree. The place where the tree touches the dirt, you can hear me get a little agitated by this, where the tree touches the dirt, the only thing you should see is the tree, the root flare, and dirt. No mulch on the freaking base of the tree. The mulch should come, the tree should come out a bit, no dirt, and then thin mulch, and the mulch should get thicker as it goes to the drip line. All right, now let's talk about something totally different, and honestly, landscaping would be one of the valuable skills that might fit my my segment today. So again, I asked ChatGPT, I'll actually tell you the prompt that I gave it, And that will put it all in context. I said, if we had a group of 18-year-olds today looking to build a life, how might we guide them differently than my generation who were 18 in the mid to late 80s? How might we advise differently on education, career choices, investing, housing, etc.? Not so much the tech. Lots of jobs today just didn't exist then. More the macro planning. My day, it was go to college, get a degree, invest 10% in the stock market, buy a house, get good credit, get a good secure job. Give me 10 brief bullet points for today's young people. So I'm going to go through these 10 kind of quickly and add on to them so I'm not just reading a transcript. But, I mean, when you listen to this, realize I didn't change anything because I didn't feel I needed to. I might think a little bit about adding one for you here because there's one that's, you know, obviously missing to me anyway. But we'll get to that. I'll make it a bonus number 11. I'll pull it out of my butt when we get there. So number one, tell me if this doesn't sound like Jack Spirico, not ChatGPT. Learn valuable skills, not just degrees. Focus on practical income-generating skills, trade, tech, business over credentials. I want to tell you, if you're going to go to college, one of the paths in college to still consider outside of like the STEM world and things like that is going to be a business path. Business, entrepreneurship, how to, you know, all that stuff. Because if you know how to operate a business, it doesn't matter that your business is made up mostly of, let's say, AI-driven bots, or if your business is made up of human beings. They're different to manage, but the overall writing macro skill, the concept of acting as a CEO is the same. The business principles are the same. The rules of business are the same. And as well as trades and tech educations. Like, you should be out learning how to do things. And if you are 18 right now, or 17 or 16 or 15 or 40, honestly, but especially young people, you should be attending a university on a daily basis, and it's completely free. It's called YouTube University. You should be picking a skill, becoming at least halfway proficient in it, and pick another skill and do it again, and pick another skill and do it again, and pick another skill and do it again, and pick another skill and do it again. Because even if you end up going to college, that will help you. That will help you. And if you don't go, it'll really help you. You're really going to need something to lift you up and set you apart. But definitely look at different tech opportunities. There's a lot of, you know, jobs and skills out there that are fairly resistant to AI. I mean, some of the ones I can think of, again, your skilled trades, your electricians, plumbers, carpenters. Like, you're not going to have AI doing any of that shit anytime soon. Healthcare workers, AI is going to be a big part of healthcare, but like nurses, EMTs, caregivers, doctors, like that's not going away. Mental health professionals, probably educators, especially if you learn how to teach in the new paradigm where you're paid directly by your students. But that's a much better way to make a living than teaching fourth grade and teaching the same class over and over again for 50 years. Skilled ag workers, so like permaculturists and small farmers and things like that, that's not getting replaced by AI. AI will be driving the combines and planting the fields that are 40,000 acres of wheat. It's not going to do this more intensive hands-on work. Creative, like writers and artists to a degree, if you can figure out how to make money doing it. People that have to work with events, trade shows, concerts, stuff like that. Like, that needs to be, like, problem-solving on the fly. A lot of emergency services, craftspeople. There's all kinds of opportunities within, you know, the trade fields. The number two in this is avoid debt like the plague. Boy, that sounds like, considering one of my modern survival tenets is that debt is cancer. That fits there. But especially student loans, only borrow if the ROI is clear and fast. I don't know if it's got to be fast, but it needs to be clear. And I think there's a lot of people borrowing money still to go to school still because they've been told to do it the same way still, and it still is done. And so I've said this before, but if you're going to go to college, young man or young woman, then you should know what does a person with a degree in the subject matter that I'm going to take do on the day after they throw their hat in the air? What do? What does it look like? What does the first 2 years of life with that degree look like for a person that graduates, let's say, in the middle of their class? Don't assume even, I don't care if you're a valedictorian, don't assume that when you go to college, you're still going to be the smartest person in the room, and most of you ain't valedictorians, right? So you should base it on the median. What does the average person that comes out with a degree in this career field, what do they do? What does it look like 2 years in, 5 years in, 10 years in? What are the income expectations? And if that income expectation is less than laying pipe, you might want to think about laying pipe. I don't care what your mama said or your daddy said because they dream of you going to college. They had their chance to go to college. They did or they did not. They don't get to live your life for you. Then build income diversity early. Side hustles, freelancing, small business, don't rely on one paycheck. I teach that every day. Like I said, I didn't have to change much here. I'm like, this thing's actually seems like it's working, right? This ChatGPT thing working pretty damn good here. If you do not have more than one form of income in your life by the time you are 18, you are wrong. You're not bad. I don't want you to go put a bag over your face and start beating yourself with a stick or something like that, but you're wrong, and you need to fix it. I mean, I was thinking about recently, you know, if I was smart when I was a kid, if I was as smart as I thought I was when I was a teenager, I remember going to school once I got a car every day, and every once in a while I'd go buy Burger King or McDonald's or something, get like a biscuit or a croissant or whatever for breakfast, and the whole damn line was nothing but kids that I knew from high school sitting in a line at a fast food place to pay too much for a crappy meal. I could have went out and bought kind of like a flat top cook thing. I could have brought a freaking cooler of egg, cheese, and sausage and bacon sandwiches to the parking lot at the school every day, and I could probably every morning, once you get quick, you make 50, it's no big deal. I could have sold all damn 50 of them. And at $2 a piece of profit, which I ran the numbers with 80s numbers, it would have worked. I could have been putting $100 a day in my pocket. Most grown people didn't make $500 a week back then. Not where I grew up. And that would have all been cash side money, and I could have done that, and I didn't. I had little side hustles, right? I used to make people tapes, like the double tape deck thing. I had three of them by the time I got really big into it. I had a catalog with all the music I had and shit like that. And you couldn't make money doing that today, but I had something. The first thing I ever sold in my life as a kid, I got in trouble in school. It was in sixth grade, and it's when the cinnamon toothpicks took off, and my dad told me, that's just toothpicks soaked in cinnamon oil. And I said, can you get me some cinnamon oil? And he did, and a few weeks later, he got a call from the vice principal at the school that I was in trouble because I got caught selling toothpicks in school, and he told the vice principal he didn't see the problem. So I got in trouble at school, but not at home. But you should have, like, diversity. Like, my nephew, who was going through law school and got out of law school with very low debt for the law education he has, law school and college, he was selling shit in the dorms. He was buying cases of honey buns and selling. Like, there is always a fucking side hustle, and you learn so much from it. This kid's 27 years old. He's an assistant AG now. But, you know, 8 years ago, he was hustling honey buns in a college dorm. He's 28. But so 8 years ago, 9 years ago, he was hustling honey buns and iced tea. He was making iced tea by the gallon. Then some crazy-ass uncle taught him how to make things like apple cider, you know, the kind that makes you go hiccup like that. And all of a sudden, he was bootlegging booze in college. So I'm saying there's always something. And then there's all these other opportunities today, Uber and Lyft and Uber Eats and all, like something. Invest in assets that you control. Think real estate, small business, or Bitcoin over Wall Street alone. I think I've talked about those things so much, I'll just let that be what it is. But real estate, the Bitcoin community has a negative view of real estate. They really shouldn't. There are different things that work different ways. Bitcoin I have to buy with my money, real estate I can buy with somebody else's money, and then I get somebody else to pay the debt. And there's going to be a lot of renting in the future, so there's a lot of opportunity there for the smart person. But one way or another, you should have investments like this says, you should control. I control my Bitcoin, not the bank. You know? Five is rent smart or co-house until it is strategic to buy. My generation was taught, by the time you're 24, 25, you should own a house. If you went to college, you got out at 22, 23, okay, 26, 27, you should own a house. And I still think if you can find the opportunity, that's good advice, but doing it just to do it is dumb. Always has been. Always has been. I bought my first house at 24. I don't know how many 24-year-olds could pull it off today. I really don't. If you can, you should, but you should do it smart. You have to be really smart, and I think you're going to see more. And I did the roommate thing. But I think the co-housing thing will continue to rise. It's hard to deal with roommates sometimes, but there's a whole bunch of young people still living at home. Young man or woman, if you live at home and you don't pay your parents anything to stay there, stop that shit right now. You need to be making enough money that you can give them a couple $100 because you are now a parasite instead of a child, okay? So you need to start acting like a good home guest because that's what you are now. Once you're one day over 18, there ain't nothing but their love for you that keeps your parents from saying, here's a box of Hefty Sacks. And when you say, what's that for? To pack your shit and get out. And they call the sheriff, and he will throw you out for them. So you are there at their benevolence. You should be contributing. However, there is no place in the world you're going to live for $200 a month. You should be saving 40 to 50% of your fucking money, okay? 40 to 50% of your money should be going into savings, and probably more, but at least 40 to 50%. And I'm going to save on the investment because it was pretty brief, the investment advice. That's going to be my number 11. I'll say more on the percentage of income thing at the end. The next thing is, so what I'm saying is if you are living at home, you should be saving up money fast. You should be making those multiple income streams. You should be working extra hours. Fuck going out and partying until 2 o'clock in the morning and shit like that. You should work, work, work. Like, your parents should be like, I don't mind that he or she is staying here because he's never here because he's always working. He works, comes home, goes to sleep, and goes back to work. Comes home, studies, goes to sleep, goes back to work, whatever it is. Comes home, works at home on something for his income, and goes back to other work, goes to sleep. That's what your life should look like, especially if you ain't going to school. You're 18, 19 years old living at home. That's what your life should look like. And you won't have to do it forever, young person. That is the point. You do that shit for 4 or 5 years, and you can buy a house by the time you're 24, 25, and you can be set, and it can be a good thing for you when you get there. You should reward your parents for letting your dead ass live in their house for those extra years by making them so fucking proud they don't know what to do with themselves because you did so much better than your peers because you have the opportunity, and if you don't do it, you're fucking squandering it, and your parents should grab you by the cuff of your neck and throw you the fuck out in the street if you're not doing that and you're living at home. And you're that age. I mean it. Okay? Next, stay flexible, not secure. Security is a trap. Adaptability is power. In other words, you should not be looking for that job like your granddaddy had. You're going to work 30 years, 40 years, and get a gold watch because that fucking world is gone. That was gone for my generation, so it sure as hell ain't here for yours. Very few people in the world today that are, let's say, 50 years old. If you say, are you working in the same place you were when you were 25, answer that with a yes. Very few people probably answer that with a yes if you say 30 or even 35. 15 years is a long time to be in one place anymore. And when they are doing the same thing for 15, 20 or more years, they probably work for themselves. So the reason they ain't left is because it's their company, it's their business, it's their enterprise. You need flexibility, and the flexibility comes from some of the other things like the diversity of skill set. That gives you the flexibility. Next, own your brand. We just had a show on this week. This is the W-2 worker, right, instead of the entrepreneur, who still treats their life like they're the CEO of You Inc. You have to have an online presence, a portfolio, a reputation, all of that. That's the new resume. The resume has been dead for a long time. I mean, freaking LinkedIn is outdated technology for finding a job at this point, except headhunters still use it and whatnot. The reality is you should have a reputation by the time you're 25, 26, 27 years of age in the world that is you, that when someone, even if they don't know you, when they check into you, when they say, who is this person? They're like, wow. And Discover Praxis, who I had them on the show, and the way they run a boot camp and all, you, even if you don't use their service, if you go and look at what they're teaching those young people to do, you can do that for yourself. You just don't get their support. You've got to build a brand. You've got to build a brand. And it's not much different than my generation. What I was taught by my great uncles, my grandparents, the people in my family that weren't derelicts and lunatics, right? The older generation, you only have your name. Now, they meant Spirko. They meant my family name. They meant don't dishonor your family name. But the other message was, and if you don't, it will do something for you. All this is taking that to another level, pushing it up, right? You're pushing up that brand of your name beyond just, oh, he's a Spirko. Oh, that's Jack freaking Spirko. And if you don't have any idea who I am today and you go out and you Google me, you're like, wow, this guy's done a lot of shit. This guy's serious. Even if you don't like me, you can't take me as not serious. You can build that for yourself relatively quickly. I really recommend every one of you read the 4-Hour Workweek, and I'm going to add it to the show notes today with a link on Amazon, but it belongs in T-Spaz. There's two books that I need to get added. They'll get added next week. One is going to be Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek. And the other one is a little bit disconnected from that, but in the monetary world, Broken Money by Lynn Alden. Those two books, every single one of you ain't read them, need to read them or get the audiobook or what have you. Like I said, they'll be coming next week, but I'll add links to both of them in the show notes today if you want to go ahead and get on board quick. Next up is geo arbitrage when needed. Live somewhere cheap, earn from high-value markets. So if you can outsource your labor across distance, then go live somewhere where the average person is lucky to get a job at frickin' the Dollar General and earn corporate-level income like you would if you were in Atlanta or Dallas or Jacksonville or L.A. Those jobs are a little harder to come by than they were a year ago. Companies are starting to tighten that up, but there's a lot of work like that still out there. Now, the other side of that is that that does sometimes put you in competition with the outsourced people like we talked about with our guest yesterday. Like, I can hire a person out of the Philippines with a freaking bachelor's degree and quite a few years of experience that has a bunch of capabilities for between $8 and $12 an hour. I mean, I can get a really high-end person in the Philippines for $12 an hour. So if you're on that full geo-arbitrage thing, you know, you're competing with those people. That's something to know. But you can always figure out how to do things. You know, if I was going to take that path, then I would figure out what those people are weak at. Where are, like, when you, I would talk to people that hire them. And where are your biggest pain points with that person? What would make you hire someone that you're paying $30, $35 an hour over this person in your business, and find out what those are? And I would shore that up. And it may be some language stuff, but like our guest said yesterday, that's not really a thing anymore. Many of these people have realized fluent English is the path for them because they're doing this too. But it's also, when I hear geo-arbitrage, I think a little bit differently than the way ChatGPT angled this. That might mean move your ass, and it might not mean move your ass to a place that's cheap. It might mean move your ass to where the opportunity is. And when you're young, one of the things you have that people later in life, when they have kids and roots and everything like that, don't have is the ability to just pick your shit up, pack your shit up, and move. And go find the place you want to be. One of the coolest things I've ever seen a person do in my life was, I don't know how long ago it was, but it's pre-COVID, so 18, 17, something like that. This girl that my wife and I met in North Carolina, she was driving Uber Lyft. And she was hustling her way across the country. She was using something like Airbnb, but it wasn't Airbnb. It's more specialized in finding like rooms, cheap rooms. And so she was using that to find a place to live. You know, and it's not a big security deposit or anything. You know, if you get whatever vetting the site does that says this person's not going to murder you in your sleep, you just get a room and move into it. And she's moving in like 30, 60, 90 days per location. Very, very cheap to live that way. Take her car, drive to where she was, and switch her Uber credentials to that state. And then she was driving and making money and learning the place. Who's there? Making friends, making contacts, making connections. Who hires? Where's the best place to work here? What are they looking for? Meeting the people that hired people. Not to, like, I'm not looking for a job right now, but I might move here soon. And if I do, I want to know who to talk to. That approach. When that person comes back, you want to talk to him as a hiring manager. And she's like, I'm going to do this for 2 years. At the end of 2 years, my student loans will be paid off in full. I'll have some money in the bank. I'll have lived in about a dozen places. I'll have friends all over the country, contacts all over the country, and then I'll decide where I want to live. Brothers and sisters, you ain't going to do that when you're 35. Now, somebody out there in my audience might go do it just to spite me, and it might benefit them to do so. I'm saying the aggregate average person that's 35 years old ain't going to do that. But the 22 to 24-year-old that's recently out of college can do that on a whim. And what a great way to find yourself, right? That's another type of geo-arbitrage. Learn basic self-reliance. Learn to look after your health, how to cook, how to eat healthy, how to manage your own finances, right? How to manage your own legal issues to a degree. Like, so that you only rely on professionals for that level which with a professional should be relied upon, right? If you are going out to eat five times a week and telling me you're broke, I don't want to hear you. And I know some of you are like, man, you post pictures of going out to eat all the time. Yeah, and I don't bitch about being broke either, do I? Let me tell you something. When I was broke, that shit didn't happen. When I was a broke-ass young man and I first moved here to Texas and my first job was packing boxes in a warehouse and the Roach Coach came and all the people that cried about not making enough money went to the Roach Coach, I grabbed my lunch and I sat down next to him and I ate my lunch. And my lunch was probably better than what they were eating out of the damn Roach Coach. If you don't know what a Roach Coach is, look it up, okay? It's just what they call a food truck here in Texas. And then the next one that they have is question the script. If it was normal in 1985, double check to see if it still serves you. If you're getting advice and you're like, that sounds like boomer advice, it might be. And that don't mean it's bad advice. There is some overlap. But you need to immediately be suspectful of anything that sounds like the advice that somebody would give a person in 1985. I completely agree with that. The last one I want to do is talk a little bit more about investing. So the investment advice my generation got, and it was pretty damn solid advice for income levels, opportunities, etc., was save 10% of your money. Save 10% of your money until you have a 90-day emergency fund. Just have that in something like laddered CDs or a savings account or a money market. And from that point forward, 10% of your money goes into your 401k. If you don't have a 401k, open an IRA. 10% of your income goes into your IRA. That was our advice. And if you can't, if you max out the retirement account, then take the balance and put it, still save it. Still, like if you get to like your limit on what you can contribute, take the, you know, like you did 10% for 8 months. For the last 4 months, put that 10% somewhere else. Put it in cash. Hold, if you're going to invest, invest out. You know, not everything has to be in a 401k. I don't think that gets it done for you anymore, folks. I think a young person today needs to be saving at a minimum 15% of their income, and 20 is better. And I know what a lot of young people are going to tell me. I can't afford it. Yeah, but here's the thing. And this is something, I didn't like it when somebody told me this when I was 19 years old. I didn't like it. And I didn't like it because it was true then and it's true now. And this will be true forever. If I gave you a 20% raise in your pay, you'd be very happy for a couple weeks. You'd realize you had more money for a couple months. And within a couple months, your life would adapt such that it would be like you never got a raise. And you'd go back to your employer, I need more money. I need more money. I need more money. That, and it would be a perpetual whirlwind. Which means the exact same thing is true in reverse. If you start saving 20% of your money, it will hurt really bad and you'll feel like you have less money for a couple weeks, and then you'll feel a little bit for a couple months, and after that you won't even notice it anymore. And as you get raises to your income going forward, the percentage of what you keep or the amount that you keep will go up commensurate like it would anyway, and you'll begin that new adaptation. And by the way, when we were given that advice, and if you had asked, like, you know, my economics teachers or my business teachers in high school, well, you know, Mr. Birch, if I have a full-time job and I'm saving 10% of my income and I have we wouldn't call it a side hustle, but a part-time gig or something like that back then, like, if I have that too, do I have to save 10%? He would have said, no. No, that's extra money. You do what you want with that. I mean, it'd be good. Maybe you should save it, or maybe you're doing that to buy something like a, you know, a boat or a house, and then you should save all of it. But as far as like your long term, like savings, no, you can, that's extra money. If you just save 10% of your salary, you'll be okay. I don't care where your money comes from. At least 15%, if you are 20, 25 years old right now, needs to be saved. Now, what does that mean? If you buy Bitcoin, you saved it. If you invest it in stocks and you're not an idiot, know how you do that, you saved it. If it's in a cash account, you saved it. If it's in a safe in your floor, you saved it. If you buy silver, you saved it. You see what I'm saying? It doesn't have to be a 401k, and all of it shouldn't be in a 401k. But minimum 15%, 10% just doesn't work anymore with the math and the metrics. That's the new world that we're in today, folks. That's the reality that we're in today. And the biggest problem I have with the establishment as it relates to Gen Z, no one's telling them what I just did. No one's saying this. They're all being told the same bullshit lie. You should go to college, somebody else should pay for it, and you should have free health care, and then you should get a really good job, and by the time you're 30, you should be set with a good income, and then you shouldn't have any debt because it was already paid for you. Okay, and you should also have a unicorn that flies over your house and shits a rainbow out, farts out a rainbow, and your fucking guardian angel should slide down the rainbow and grant you three wishes, and that should happen once a week. because those two things are just about as likely to happen as the other one. Okay? This is what we need to be telling our young people today. Yes, it's hard. Yes, it's worth it. Your life can be fucking amazing by the time you're 30, or you can question why you went through all the bullshit you did and why you don't have any joy in your life by the time you're 30, and it's really a binary choice to a large degree. And your behavior will have more impact on that than who you were born to, what the color of your skin is, what your sex is, what, you know, anything is outside of your control. Your behavior will be the number one determining factor in your success or failure in life. We do not teach people that anymore. And your behavior is not just stay the fuck out of prison, right? That's not what it, or, you know, you don't get fired from every job you have. Don't go out and make babies when you're 17 years old. Like, that's all good advice, and that's behavioral advice. And that advice, in general, is still given mostly. Of course, we didn't want to shame anybody or anything that already made the mistake. The person that made the mistake, you should be saying, hey, look, don't do it anymore. But no, we're going to pat everybody on the head, tell them it's all going to be fine. And that's how we've gotten... The generation in between Z and Xers right now is the most entitled, spoiled generation on the planet, and it damn sure ain't all of you. There are some hard-working, very successful, amazing millennials out there. But when we talk about which generation has the most crybaby bitches, it's that millennial generation. And it ain't your fault, but it is your problem. So you can take all the advice I just gave that 20-year-old and think, man, I wish somebody would have told me that when I was 20. Start now. Start now. Because the best time to start was when you're 18, 20 years old. The next best time to start is today. And a worse time to start than today is tomorrow. And it's damn sure not going to be any better to start in 5 or 10 years. We labor under this belief, if I just keep doing it, eventually my ship will come in, eventually I'll get lucky, eventually somebody will offer me a better job. It won't matter. If you don't change your behavior, even when luck finds its way to you, you will find a way to screw it up. With that, I hope you enjoyed today's show. Again, let me remind you, if you like the show and the work that we do, check out tspaz.com. You can find everything that I recommend there, all my reviews, products I've used for years. If I wouldn't spend my money on it, I wouldn't recommend it to you. And if you are going to buy anything online, just start at tspaz.com. Even if it's not something I recommend, as long as you start there, you can help us out no matter what you buy from Vavor or from Amazon, which, you know, the biggest online retailer in the world is Amazon. You're going to buy something there, please go buy tspaz.com first. And think about becoming an MSB member today if you've never had or your account's expired. I get you such great discounts. I'm working on one right now from a company that does mushroom spawn. I'm pretty excited. I finally got one of those guys who wants to play ball with us. It's somebody I've used before, I've reached out to before, and I hit the right note with them this time, and we're going to get that done for you. You know, we got moonshine stills, we got cannabis products, we got seeds, we got plants, we got all kinds of stuff available in the MSB at deep discounts, and those discounts will cover your membership. Above Phone does a discount for MSB. Start 9 Servers does a discount for MSB. There's all kinds of really great programs there. If you've never checked it out, check it out. Tomorrow we'll have a Friday flashback, and I mean it this time. I won't do what I did last week. I didn't do it. I flaked out, and by the time I realized it, I was already on the way out the door with my wife, and I said, oh, it'll be all right. But I'm going to get that done as soon as I'm done with this episode for you, so you'll have that flashback tomorrow, and then next week we shall do it all over again. And about the end of the month, remember, I will be at the LFTN Living Free in Tennessee workshop with Nicole Sauce. I'll be there for the entire workshop. I'm there the day before and the day after I'm leaving. It should be great. I think she's got a couple tickets left. With that, I'll catch you later. I'll catch you on Monday, I guess. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.